I am writing this as fast as I can. I am galloping through hostile territory like the Pony Express because I absolutely must deliver the mail. I've already taken my fair share of arrows, and though I'm clearly wounded, I am not dead. Not yet. I'm trying mightily to remember everything germane. I'm a bit shaky on the timeline, on the cause and effects, on specificity. I am freely and honestly admitting to this. Just so, when all the little editors begin flourishing their red pencils, and they will, I'll have hopefully, if only momentarily, dulled the momentum of their onrushing venom. I don't blame them. I truly don't. I am, after all, the boy who cried wolf, who shouted, screamed, and plastered it across 2-inch headlines. Mea culpa. All I can tell you is that what I'm writing in this claustrophobic motel room is the absolute, unvarnished, 100% truth. So help me God, scout's honor, cross my heart and hope to die. Change hope to expect. This isn't just my last story. It's my last will and testament. Pay attention. You are my executor. One brief digression. Writing my last story, I can't help but remember my first. I was 9. It was snowing. Not the paltry dusting that generally passed for snow in Queens, New York. No, the sky was actually dumping snow, as if someone had loosened a giant salt shaker top up there. Icicles were being blown off our sagging gutters and straight into the brick walls of the house, where they splintered with the sound of ball meeting bat. Schools would be closed all week. "My brother Jimmy slipped on the ice and he hit his head," I wrote on neatly lined composition paper. "He is always falling down and stuff like that. He walked into a door and he got a black eye. Last week he fell down in the tub and he burnt himself. He is really clumsy, and my mom keeps telling him to watch where he's going, but he don't listen. He is only 6. I brought the story into the kitchen where my mother was slumped over the table, staring into an empty bottle of Johnny Walker.
"Read this to me," she slurred.
After I finished, she said,
"Okay, good. I want you to memorize it. They'll be here in an hour."
Chapter 2. There were no storm warnings. No emergency disaster center urging me to board up the windows and leave town. I can look back to that day, borrow a cliché. I apologize to my first journalism professor, who abhorred clichés as much as he abhorred the newly instituted no fraternization with co-eds rule, and state that with the exception of Belinda Washington turning 100, absolutely nothing that day was out of the ordinary. Ordinary, after all, was pretty much the daily state of affairs in Littleton, California, approximately 153 miles east of L.A. Change approximately to exactly. 2 years ago, I'd driven every mile of it in my last certifiably owned possession, a silver-blue Miata, purchased back when Miatas were hot shit. A case could be made that back then I was, too. Now the Miata was ignobly dented in 2 separate places with a sluggish transmission that complained loudly when asked to change gears. On the morning in question, I was summoned into Hinch's office and told to cover Belinda Washington's centennial. Clearly a human interest piece. You could safely state that every article in the Littleton Journal was a human interest piece. It went to press only 5 times a week. Sometimes less if not enough local news had taken place since the previous issue. The only serious news stories that made it into the town's paper were picked up from the AP, stories that came from places like Baghdad and Kabul, where you could almost smell the cordite emanating off the type. I perused them longingly, as if they were dirty French postcards from a long-ago era. Belinda Washington was from a long-ago era. You could intuit that from the wheelchair and her nearly bald pate. When I entered the day room of Littleton's only senior citizen home, she was wearing a ridiculous paper tiara with the number 100 printed on it. It was obviously someone's idea of cute. Probably not Belinda's. She didn't look happy as much as bewildered. I dutifully maintained my objectivity and resisted the urge to knock it off her head. These days I was strictly adhering to the noble tenets of my profession. I introduced myself to the managing director of the home, a Mr. Birdwell, who was orchestrating the august occasion with the aid of a digital camera. Good. That would save me from having to snap any pictures. On the Littleton Journal, we multitasked. I kneeled down in front of Belinda and introduced myself in a louder-than-normal voice. "Hello, Mrs. Washington. Tom Valley from the Littleton Journal."
"What you shouting for?"
Belinda asked, grimacing. Evidently, Belinda wasn't any fonder of patronizing reporters than she was of paper tiaras.
"Take that thing off my head," she added.
Gladly. I stood up and removed the tiara, handing it to one of the male attendants, who looked personally miffed that I'd intruded on their fun.